towel, so when she got dressed again, her hair, still wet, dampened her shoulders and her shirt. But she felt better. Cleaner. A father. She experimented with holding the idea for 2-3 seconds at a time, now without shame. She brushed up next to it, got close, sniffed around it like an animal exploring something new. What would it be like to have a father? What did a father actually do? She had no idea. She came outside into a night loud with distant laughter and the sound of tree frogs. She didn't see Selim. She took a turn of the building and found him in the back hurling rocks into the growth where the dirt clearing petered out into cypress and shade trees. Selim? He didn't turn around, and thinking he hadn't heard, she took another step forward. Selim? Don't call me that. He turned to face her, his face caught in the flare of the floodlights, and her stomach went hollow. He looked as if he hated her.
That's not my name.
This time he directed a volley of rocks at the restrooms, so they pinged against the stucco walls and the sign pointing the way to the showers.
I'm 72. I'm a replica. A human model. Only humans have names.
Then she knew that what she'd been afraid of was true. He hated her for what she was, or for what she wasn't. You're wrong, Lyra said. She felt as if she were being squeezed between two giant plates, as if the whole world had narrowed to this moment. That isn't what makes the difference.
Oh, yeah? You would know, I guess.
He looked away.
I thought we were the same, but we're not. We're different. You're different.
So what? Lyra took a step closer to him. They were separated by less than a foot, but he might have been on the other side of the world. She felt reckless, desperate, the same way she'd felt running after Haven had exploded. He turned back to her, frowning. So we're different. Who cares? We chose to escape together. We chose to stay together. We chose each other. Didn't we? I gave you a name, she almost said, but the memory of that night and lying so close to him while the darkness stirred around his body made her throat constrict. That's what makes the difference. Getting to choose, and what you choose. She took a breath. I choose you.
How can you?
His voice was raw.
You know what I am. I don't belong anywhere.
You belong with me. When she said it out loud, she knew it was true. Please. She'd never had to ask for anything because she'd never had reason to. But this woke inside of her, the asking and the need, the feeling that if he didn't say yes, she wouldn't be able to go on. Please, she repeated because she could say nothing else. But at the same time, she took a step toward him and put a hand on his chest above his heart, because there was always that to return to, always the truth of its rhythm and the fact that every person, no matter how they were formed or where, had a heart that worked the same way. They were inches apart. His skin was hot, and though she could feel him, touch him, know his separateness, in that moment, she also learned something totally new. That it was possible by touching someone else to dissolve all the space between them.
I am no one, he said.
In his eyes, she was reflected in duplicate.
I was made to be no one.
You're someone to me, she said. You're everything. He took her face in his hands and kissed her. They had never learned how to kiss, either of them, but somehow he knew. She did too. It was beyond instinct. It was joy. They were clumsy still. They stumbled, and then she was against the wall. She pulled herself into him and found to her amazement that her body knew more than how to ache or shiver or exhaust itself. It knew how to sing. They barely touched except with their mouths, the way they explored together, teeth, tongue, lips, the way they shivered with the joy of discovery. They were born for the first time in their bodies. They were born together. They came together into the world as everyone should, frightened, uncertain, amazed, grateful. And for them, the world was born, too, in all its complexity and strange glory. They had a place in it, at last. And so at last it became theirs to share. No matter what happened, no matter what trouble came, Lyra knew they would face it together. As they were then, turned human by joy, by a belonging that felt just like freedom.
Gemma. Chapter 1. Escape. That was what Gemma dreamed of, especially on nights like this one, when the moon was so big and bright it looked like it was a set piece in a movie, hooked outside her window on a curtain of dark night sky. In movies, teenagers were always sneaking out. They'd wait until their parents went to bed, ease out from under their blankets already dressed in miniskirts and tank tops, slide down the stairs and unlatch the lock, and pop, they'd burst out into the night, like balloons squeezing through a narrow space only to explode. Other teenagers, Gemma guessed, didn't have Rufus, a 75-pound retriever who seemed to consist entirely of fur, tongue, and vocal cords. "Shh," Gemma hissed as Rufus greeted her at the bottom of the stairs, wiggling so hard she was surprised he didn't fall over. "Are you all right?" She'd been awake for only a minute, but already her mother was at the top of the stairs, squinting because she didn't have her contacts in, dressed in an old Harvard t-shirt and sweatpants. "I'm fine, Mom." Gemma grabbed a glass from the cabinet. She would never sneak out. Not that she had anywhere to sneak out to, or anyone to sneak out with, since April's parents kept her just as leashed up as Gemma's did. Still, she imagined for a second that she was halfway to the door, dressed in tight jeans and a shirt that showed off her boobs, the only part of her body she actually liked, on her way to hop in her boyfriend's car, instead of standing in a darkened kitchen in her pajamas at 11 p.m. on a Wednesday night, while Rufus treated her ankles to one of his signature lick jobs. "Just needed some water." "Are you dehydrated?" Her mom said dehydrated, as if it meant dying. "I'm fine." Gemma rattled the ice in her glass as she returned up the stairs, deliberately avoiding her mom's eyes. "Go back to bed, okay?" Her mom, Christina, hesitated. "Let me know if you need anything, okay?" "Uh-huh." Gemma shut her bedroom door in Rufus's face, not caring that he immediately began to whine. She set the water on her bedside table and flopped back onto the bed. The moon made squares on her bare legs, cutting her skin into portions of light and dark. She briefly let herself imagine what Chloe DeWitt and Aubrey Connolly were doing at that very second. She'd always been told she had a vivid imagination, but she just couldn't picture it. What was it like to be so totally, fundamentally, ruthlessly normal? What did they think about? What were their problems? Did they have any problems? Rufus was still whining. Gemma got out of bed and let him in, sighing as he bounded immediately onto the bed and settled down exactly in the center of her pillow. She wasn't tired yet, anyway. She sat down instead at the vanity that had once belonged to her mother, an ornate Victorian antique she'd loved as a child and hadn't been able to tell Christina she'd outgrown. She'd never been able to tell her parents much of anything. The moon made hollows of her eyes in the mirror, turned her skin practically translucent. She wondered if this was how her parents always saw her, a half-ghost, hovering somewhere between this life and the next. But she wasn't sick anymore. She hadn't been sick in years, not since she was a little kid. Still, they treated her as if she might suddenly blow away, like a human house of cards, disturbed by the lightest touch. She herself could barely remember all those years of sickness, the hospital, the operations, the treatments. Coping, her therapist said. An adaptive defense. She did remember a garden, and a statue, too. A kneeling god, she thought, but she couldn't be sure. With one arm raised to the sky, and the other reaching toward the ground, as though to draw something magic from the earth. Gemma. Chapter 2. Gemma must have been the only overweight 16-year-old girl in the entire history of the United States who actually wished she could participate in gym. It would be one thing if she were excused to go to study hall or a free period, but due to scheduling limitations, the stated reason, or, as Gemma suspected, the innate sadism of Ms. Vick, the vice principal. Instead, Gemma was forced to go to gym and sit in the bleachers, pretending to work, while the rest of her classmates zigzagged across the gym, their sneakers squeaking, or flew across the mulchy, wet soccer fields running drills. In the bleachers, there was nowhere to hide. She might as well be a blinking, does-not-belong sign. Even worse, Mrs. Coralie, the gym teacher, also a sadist, the school was full of them, insisted that Gemma change into the puckered nylon shorts and matching tank tops the whole class was forced to wear, which, on Gemma, only served to further underscore how little she belonged, like wearing full-on ski gear to the beach. "You are so lucky," April Ruiz, Gemma's best friend, swiped a lock of dark hair out of her eyes as the girls filed back into the locker room. "I'm pretty sure dodgeball was invented by the same people who thought up rectal thermometers and wool tights." "Move it, Frankenstein." Chloe DeWitt jabbed an elbow, hard, in the space where Gemma's waist should have been, if she had a waist, instead of a roll of flab. Gemma probably had 40 pounds on Chloe, but the girl was all sharp corners, and she knew how to use them to her advantage. Her elbows felt like whittled blades. "Not all of us get to spend the whole period snacking." Gemma blushed. She had never, ever eaten in class. She had hardly ever eaten in the cafeteria, precisely so that Chloe, and girls like her, would never get the opportunity to make fun of her for it. But it didn't matter. From the time Gemma was little, Chloe had made it her mission to ensure that Gemma never forgot that she was a freak. In third grade, she'd hit on the name Frankenstein after Gemma's second heart surgery had left her with a thick scar from her chest to her navel. After that, Gemma had never changed except in a bathroom stall. But no one at school besides April and her teachers ever called her anything else. What Gemma couldn't understand was why. If she were so delicate, like her parents were saying, "You're delicate, Gemma. That's why we have to be so careful. No roller coasters, Gemma. Your heart is delicate." She couldn't look delicate. Like one of the small crystal animal figurines that her mom collected and kept enclosed in the corner cabinet, with legs as thin as toothpicks. Like Chloe, with a tan that appeared permanently shellacked to the contours of her body, as finely chiseled and well-tuned as an instrument. Like she had been formed by a god with an eye for detail, whereas Gemma had been slapped together haphazardly by a drunk. "Yeah," she muttered, as Chloe and her friends converged on the sinks, laughing. "Lucky." "Don't let Cruella get to you," April said in a low voice. April always took Gemma's side. Years ago, they had decided that either they were two aliens in a school of humans, or possibly the only two humans in a school of aliens. Someone forgot to shoot her with her morning dose of tranquilizer. April and Gemma waited until Chloe in the pack of wolves, a fitting nickname for more than metaphoric reason, since Gemma was fairly sure that Aubrey Connolly had had her incisors filed into points, and wouldn't have been surprised at all to learn that she liked the taste of human flesh, had changed before they stripped. They would both be late for study hall and would have to endure another lecture from Mr. Rodham, but anything was better than changing with a pack of wolves. "Good news," April said when the rest of the locker room had cleared out. "Mom finally caved on the Green Giant. I told her it wasn't safe to drive 60 miles in that beast, much less 600. How's that for strategy? I used her own psychology against her." "And so the hunted becomes the hunter," Gemma said in her best movie announcer voice. Sometimes she thought her favorite part of the week was sitting on the wooden bench just outside the shower stalls, which hadn't been used in 20 years, talking with April while she washed her face and reapplied her makeup painstakingly, even though the result always made it look like she wasn't wearing any. Like they were in their own protected world, but not a world her parents had made for her, a world she'd chosen. "Something like that. Anyway, we'll be cruising down to Florida in our very own Lexus. Can you believe it? My brother's so pissed." Apart from Gemma's, April's parents were the most protective people Gemma knew. Neither Gemma nor April was allowed to date. Not that it mattered, since nobody wanted to date them. The list of other things they weren't allowed to do included, but was not limited to, 1. Stay up past 10 o'clock. 2. Attend any school events or dances unless they were in a large group of females only, which precluded them from going, since they had no other friends. 3. Go to Raleigh, unless April's brother, a senior, chaperoned. 4. Be on Instagram. Gemma was sure that even if she were 5'11 and a supermodel lookalike, her parents' absurd beliefs about social media, "it rots the brain, it's bad for self-esteem," would have ensured she stayed on the bottom of the social food chain. She was also sure that when her mom and April's got together, all they did was brainstorm elaborate and ever more absurd ways to make sure that both April and Gemma stayed safe, friendless, except for each other, and totally miserable. When half the junior girls decided to spend spring break in Miami, Gemma hadn't even bothered petitioning her parents to be allowed to go. She knew she had just about as much chance of being named the first female president of the United States at age 16. Besides, she had no desire to spend her vacation bumping into the same predator she spent all her time deliberately avoiding at school. But April, who was not only prettier, smarter, and far more optimistic than Gemma, so much so that had they not been absolute, sworn, lifelong best friends, co-aliens, outcasts together, Gemma would have despised her, hadn't given in so easily. She'd begged her parents. She'd cried. She had thrown a tantrum, a risky proposition since her mother, Angela Ruiz, a renowned prosecutor for the state, had been known to frighten grown men into confessions at their first meeting. And her other mother, Diana, was a computer programmer who had won several kickboxing competitions in her early 20s. Then, the miraculous had happened. April hit on the magic word, sexism. It was sexism, April claimed, that her older brother, Ryan, got to go on spring break with his friends. It was sexism that he got to drive a Lexus while she was stuck with the Green Giant, an ancient chartreuse station wagon. And even though Ryan was 2 years older and the Lexus had been a congratulations gift for getting into Harvard early action, suddenly April's moms had generated a counteroffer. April and Gemma could take the car and drive down to Bowling Springs, Florida for a week, where April's grandparents lived. Even better, they had convinced Gemma's parents that it was a good idea. And, yeah, sure, maybe hanging out in a community known for its 65-plus dating scene and competitive weekly badminton tournament wasn't exactly the spring break of every girl's dream, but it was better than nothing. They could stay for a whole 9 days, paddle around the pool, walk down to the community tennis courts, and take their car to the beach. They could drink virgin piña coladas and sample fried gator at the local restaurants. Still better, they would have the house to themselves for 3 full days while April's grandparents were off attending some weird positive visualization health retreat that involved a lot of yoga and deep breathing, a minor detail Gemma had managed to avoid in all of her conversations with her parents. Discussing spring break plans with her best friend made Gemma feel all-American, beauty magazine, country song normal. So much so that she wasn't sure she actually wanted to go, just so she could keep talking about it. April had to hop, haul, and wiggle to get into her jeans. Her preferred fit, she always said, was human sushi roll. Gemma's was airy trash bag. "I'll pick you up Saturday at 8 a.m. Got it?" "Got it," Gemma said. They'd agreed on Saturday, March 19th, 8 a.m., weeks ago, but reconfirmed almost every day. Why not? This was the first adventurous thing either of them had ever done in their lives, unless you counted microwaving peeps at Easter to watch them explode. Gemma wished she only felt excited. She wished more than anything that her parents' words and warnings hadn't over time worked their way like a virus into her cells, replicating there. She wished she wasn't also just the littlest, tiniest bit scared. But she told herself nothing would happen. After all, nothing ever did. Gemma. Chapter 3. A list of all the medical conditions Gemma had had since she was born. 1. 2 broken tibias. 2. 1 collapsed lung. 3. Congenital heart failure. 4. Pneumonia. 5. Poison ivy. On her butt, of all places. 6. Pneumonia again. 7. A fractured wrist. 8. Hypothyroidism. 9. Pneumonia. A third time. A list of some of the medical conditions she had not had. 1. The bubonic plague. 2. That disease where you stay really skinny, no matter how much you eat. Every so often, when Gemma approached the massive iron gates that encircled her property, she got a flash of something. Not memory exactly, but something close to it, like the sudden recollection of a song you heard someone sing only once. There was a high fence lost somewhere in the wild tangle of fever dreams that had so often been hers as a very young child. A high fence, a giant statue of a man kneeling in the dirt, reaching, it seemed, simultaneously for heaven and hell. The driveway was exactly 1/4 mile long. Gemma knew because one time she had asked her mom to measure it in the car. It bisected an enormous lawn spotted with ancient spruce trees and flowering dogwood. On days when April had chorus, taking the bus and walking the 1/4 mile up the driveway was infinitely preferable to having her dad's driver pick her up, which would require that she wait at the student drop-off area, in full view of the senior playing fields, and would be a tacit admission that she had only one friend to drive her. Besides, it was practically the only exercise Gemma got. On nice days, she walked deliberately slowly, making it last, enjoying the smell of freesia and honeysuckle, and listening to the faint whine of the mosquitoes clustered in the shade. Today, she walked quickly, too preoccupied by the plans for Saturday. The day after tomorrow. A 10-hour road trip. A real adventure. With her best friend. To care about the prettiness of the day. Because of the landscaping and the angle of the drive, she was practically on the front porch before she noticed 2 cop cars, one of which had its doors swinging open, as if the officers had been in too much of a hurry to bother closing them. Her mother was speaking to one of them, holding her throat with one hand. "Dad," Gemma thought immediately and, without realizing it, broke into a run, her backpack jogging against her back.
"Gemma!"
Christina turned to stare as Gemma arrived in front of her, already panting, sweat gathering beneath the waistband of her jeans and trickling down her spine. She reached out and seized Gemma's shoulders.
"What's the matter? Is everything okay?"
Gemma stared.
"What do you mean, is everything okay?"
She gestured to the cop cars, and the cop who stood a little ways apart from mother and daughter, hands on his hips, sunglasses on, staring up at the sky as though debating whether he might still get a tan at this angle.
"What's going on?"
"Oh."
Christina exhaled loud and long, releasing Gemma's shoulder.
"This? It's nothing. Something stupid, a prank."
By then, Gemma had noticed that one of the large glass panes of the French doors was shattered, as if something heavy had been hurled through it. She could see a second cop moving through the living room, placing his weight delicately, his footsteps making a crunch-crunch sound on the glass. As she watched, a third cop emerged, a woman, holding what at first appeared to be a lumpy rock in an improbable shade of green between two gloved hands. But as she shifted it to show her colleague, Gemma's whole body went cold. It wasn't a rock, but a Halloween Frankenstein mask stapled at the neck. From the way the cop was handling it, Gemma knew it must be heavy. It had obviously been filled with something to help it maintain its shape.
"Oh my God."
Gemma could feel the blood pounding in her temples.
"Chloe. That fucking bitch."
She focused on thinking logically so that she wouldn't start to cry. How had it happened? How had Chloe arrived so much quicker than the bus? Could she have cut last period? No. Gemma had seen her getting into Aubrey's car. And how had they gotten past the gates? The whole property was fenced in. But she was sure Chloe and Aubrey were to blame, would have staked her life on it. Frankenstein. The misshapen monster.
"It's all right, Jem. It's all right,"
Christina said in a shrill voice, as if she didn't quite believe it.
"No one was hurt."
That only made Gemma feel worse. No one was hurt meant someone could have been hurt. What if her mom had been in the living room? Unlikely, of course, even though the house, Chateau Ives, as April called it, only half-jokingly, could have fit an army during wartime. Her mom never went anywhere except her bedroom, the kitchen, the downstairs yoga studio, and the bathroom, as if she were controlled by a centrifugal force that kept her rotating between those four places. But what if Ender and Bean, their cats, had been curled up on the sofa? What if Rufus had been sunning himself on the rug?
"If you want us to file a report, we'll need you down at the station," said the cop with sunglasses, the one who looked bored. But he was doing his best to be polite. The Ives family, he'd obviously been told, was important. Christina shook her head.
"I don't know," she said. "If only Jeff..."
She trailed off.
"My husband is in a meeting,"
she said by way of explanation. Gemma's dad was always in a meeting, or in a car, or on a plane.
"How'd they get in?"
Gemma blurted. The front gates could only be opened by a code. Guests had to be buzzed in. Chateau Ives meets Fort Knox. Christina blushed. Even when she blushed, she looked pretty. Gemma had tried for years to find herself in her mother's model pretty face, in her high cheekbones and slender wrists. The most she could detect was a similar way of frowning.
"There were vendors in and out for Sunday's horse show," she explained, half to Gemma, half to the police. "Florists, the planner,
I left the gates open so they wouldn't have to keep buzzing. Which no doubt meant I popped a Klonopin and had a glass of wine and took a nap. Since her parents never said exactly what they meant, Gemma had become adept at translating for them.
Fink, look at this.
Yet another cop came jogging out of the front door. He, too, was wearing nylon gloves and holding a note written on a scrap of paper between his pointer and middle fingers.
This came with a special delivery.
The bored-looking cop flipped his sunglasses to the top of his head and read without reaching for it. The message was short, but Gemma felt the anger roil inside of her, pulling her heart down to her toes. You're sick. You're a monster. You deserve to die. Christina gasped as though she'd been physically slapped. Fink nodded, and the other cop withdrew, bagging the note carefully in plastic. Gemma imagined seeing Chloe arrested, her hands wrenched behind her back, her face squashed against the top of a cop car. She imagined her thrown into jail for the rest of her life, bunking with a murderous boulder with a name like Princess. She imagined wrapping her hands around Chloe's neck and watching it snap.
I think I'd better come with you, Christina said.
Now the blush was gone. She just looked pale and confused.
Who would do something like this? Who would be so awful?
Have you or your husband been having any problems lately? Fink asked. Disputes? Legal issues?
Christina shook her head.
No other threatening messages or phone calls?
She again shook her head.
I just can't imagine. Mom, wait.
Gemma felt the words like nausea.
It's my fault. It's because everyone thinks I'm a freak.
Her mom knew that Gemma had a rough time in school, but Christina's sympathy always made Gemma feel worse. The only thing more painful than being unpopular was being the unpopular daughter of a former popular girl. She took a deep breath.
I know. What?
I know who did it. Now all the cops were watching her. Pityingly, she thought. She felt her cheeks heating up and was absolutely positive she did not look pretty like her mom. When Gemma blushed, she looked as if two pigments were trying to throttle each other beneath her skin. It's just some stupid girl at school. She probably thought it'd be funny. Was it her imagination? Or did her mom, just for the tiniest second, look relieved?
Oh, honey,
she said, and started to put her arms around Gemma. Gemma sidestepped her. It's fine, she said. I'm fine.
You still want to file the report?
Fink asked, but Gemma could tell he no longer thought it was a good idea. The whole vibe had changed. No one was looking at her. The cops were loading up, restless, eager to get back to more important things than some high school girl's social humiliation. Maybe they were annoyed they'd been dragged out here in the first place.
It's up to you, sweet pea.
Christina reached out and threaded her hand through Gemma's hair.
What do you think?
Gemma shook her head. As tempting as it was to imagine Chloe in a prison orange jumpsuit, surely even Chloe wouldn't look good in prison orange. She knew that if she made a big deal out of it, things would only get worse. Then she'd be Frankenstein the crybaby, the alien snitch. Still, she felt the sudden, overwhelming desire to scream. Chloe and her little pack of wolverines had been doing their best to make Gemma miserable for years. But they had never done anything this bad. They'd come to her house. They'd taken the time to fill a Halloween mask with rocks or concrete rubble or metal shrapnel from their mechanical hearts. They had said that she deserved to die. Why? What had she ever done to them? She was an alien, adrift on an unfriendly planet, hopeless and lost.
Are you sure?
Christina said, smoothing Gemma's face with a thumb. Gemma was scowling. She took a step backward. Positive, she said.
Okay.
Christina exhaled a big breath and gave Fink a weak smile.
Sorry for all the trouble. You know how girls are.
Mm-hmm,
he said, in a tone that he made it clear he didn't, and had no desire to, either. Gemma felt like going straight to her room, possibly forever, but Christina managed to get an arm around her shoulders. For a thin woman, she was surprisingly strong, and she held Gemma there in a death grip.
I'm sorry, honey, she said. Why didn't you tell me you were having problems at school?
She shrugged. It's no big deal. Christina smelled, as always, like rose water and very expensive perfume. So expensive that it actually smelled like new printed money.
I don't want your father to worry, do you?
She smiled, but Gemma read anxiety in her mother's eyes. Decoded the words her mother would never say. I don't want him to think you're more of a disappointment than he already does.
Let's just tell him there was an accident. A kid and a baseball, something like that.
To hit a baseball from the street through the living room window, the kid would have to be a first draft pick for the major leagues. Usually her parents' willingness to lie about things big and small bothered Gemma. If her parents were so good at making up stories, how could she ever be sure they were telling the truth? Today, however, she could only be grateful. Baseball, she said. Sure. Gemma woke up in the middle of the night from a nightmare that, thankfully, released her almost as soon as she opened her eyes, leaving only the vague impression of rough hands and the taste of metal. In the hall, Rufus was whimpering.
What's the matter? She said, easing out of bed to open the door for him.
As soon as she did, she heard it. The sudden swell of overlapping voices, the angry punctuation of silence. Her parents were fighting.
It's okay, boy, she whispered to Rufus, threading a hand through the scruff of fur on his neck.
He was a baby about fights. Immediately, he darted past her and leapt onto the bed, burying his head in her heap of pillows, as if to block out the sound from downstairs. She would have gone back to bed, but at exactly that moment, her father's voice crested, and she very clearly heard him say,
"Frankenstein, for Christ's sake, why didn't you tell me?"
Gemma eased out into the hall, grateful for the plush rug that absorbed the sound of her footsteps. Quickly, she moved past paneled squares of moonlight, past guest rooms always empty of guests, and marble-tiled bathrooms no one ever used, until she reached the main staircase. Downstairs, a rectangle of light yawned across the hallway. Her father's study door was open, and Gemma got a shock. Her mother was perched on the leather ottoman, her face pale and exhausted-looking, her arms crossed at the waist to keep her bathrobe closed. Gemma had never, ever seen anyone besides her father in the study. She had always assumed no one else was allowed to enter.
"I tried calling."
Her mother's voice was weak and a little bit slurred, as if all the edges were lopped off. It must be after midnight. He must have woken her up from a sleeping pill slumber.
"Feeding me some bullshit story. I had to hear it from Frank at the department. Thank God someone respects me."
Gemma's heart sank. It had been stupid to believe that they could conceal the truth from her father. He had contacts everywhere, in the police department and even in the government, although he kept his most important contacts secret. He'd co-founded the sixth largest pharmaceutical company in the country, Fine and Ives, which made everything from shampoo to heart medication to drugs for soldiers suffering from PTSD. Although he'd been kicked off the board of his own company after a brutal 3-year legal battle when Gemma was a toddler, Gemma had never found out the details, but she knew her dad had disapproved of where the company was putting its resources. He still traveled with a personal security guard and went to Washington, D.C. every quarter to meet with politicians and lobbyists and top brass. Often, Gemma feared she would never, ever get truly away from her parents, not even when she went to college, not even when she moved out and moved as far away from Chapel Hill as possible and had her own family. They would always be able to find her. They would always be able to see her, wherever she was.
"I respect you,"
Christina protested, and Gemma got a sudden strangled feeling, as if a hand were closing around her throat. Her father was 12 years older than Christina. He and his twin brother, Ted, had both been to West Point, like their father before them. Jeffrey had gone on to become a military strategist, and he never let anyone, least of all Gemma and her mom, forget it. Respect. That was the drumbeat of their lives. Respect. He could write a book, she thought, about respect, and discipline, and order, and work. He could probably write a whole series. On the other hand, what he knew about acceptance and tolerance and his own daughter would barely fill up a tweet. Sometimes Gemma wondered how it was possible they were made from the same genetic material. Her father was angular and cold everywhere, she was warm and soft and sensitive. But the proof was there. She would have so much rather looked like her mother. Instead, she had her father's hazel eyes, his square chin, his way of smiling with the corners of his mouth turned down, as if neither of them had ever quite learned to do it correctly. "I didn't want to worry you," Gemma's mom went on. "Gemma said it was just a prank. Some girls have been giving her a hard time at school and..."
"A prank, Christina? Are you blind? This wasn't a prank. This was a message. Do you know who Frankenstein is?"
"Of course I know.
Frankenstein is the doctor. In the original story, in the real version, he's the one who made the monster."
There was a long moment of silence. Gemma could feel her heart beating painfully, swollen like a bruise.
"This was a message for me."
"He's the one who made the monster. This was a message for me." She tried to love her father. She tried to believe he loved her, as Christina insisted that he did. She had made excuses, the same ones her mom always parroted back to her. "He's bad at expressing feelings. He's stressed at work. He didn't get a lot of love from his father." But deep, deep down, Gemma had always suspected that the reason her father avoided her, the reason he could barely look her in the eye, the reason he kept all her baby pictures locked up in drawers and desks instead of proudly on display in frames, the reason he could hardly speak to her without losing his temper, as if she were always paying for a crime she didn't know she had committed, was much simpler. He couldn't stand her. He thought she was a disappointment, a defective model, but one, sadly, that couldn't be exchanged or returned. Her mother said something else, something Gemma didn't hear. There was a high whining in her ears, as if they were filled with bees. She wanted to turn around and run, to flee back to her bedroom, to wake and realize this had all been a dream. But she couldn't move.
"There was a breach at Haven," her father said.
"What do you mean, breach?"
"Apparently, one of them escaped," Jeff said.
A long pause.
"Well, it won't live. No way can it live. The current's on that island."
"But what if it does? Jesus Christ, Christina. Can you imagine? Can you imagine the absolute shitstorm if the story gets out? We'll be persecuted. We'll be executed.
Christina's voice rose in pitch. No one will know what we've done, she says. How could they? Her father barked out a laugh, an angry, bitter sound.
There are ways. Trust me. All you have to do is follow the money.
But you left Fine and Ives for that reason. You refused to participate.
Too little, too late. I knew what Saperstein was planning. I knew where the new round of funding would go.
Gemma could no longer follow the thread of the conversation. Still, she remained motionless, gripping the banister, trying to squeeze down a mounting scream. She could see her mother worrying the hem of her bathrobe between her fingers, and her father pacing, passing in and out of view. The angle made it impossible to see his face. A small blessing. After a while, he spoke again.
Bowling Springs is only 50 miles from Haven.
Gemma's mother looked up. Her face was very pale, her eyes like two holes.
No,
she said. Gemma was shocked. She'd never heard her mother say no to her father.
You can't. Gemma's been looking forward to this trip for ages. April has been looking forward to it. What will I tell her moms?
I don't care what you tell them, he said. It isn't safe. Not after what happened today. 50 miles, Christina.
Gemma felt as if her chest had been filled with wet concrete. She couldn't breathe.
Oh, Jeff, 50 miles is a lot. You can't really believe.
I don't believe, Christina. I know.
He rounded on her, and Christina drew backward several inches. Gemma felt a sudden wave of hatred toward him, stronger than anything she'd ever felt. For one awful second, she wished for him to die, struck down by an invisible force. But that was too cruel. She wished instead that he would simply vanish. Blip, as if he'd never existed at all.
Those nutcases have been swarming the beach for months. Last week they attacked one of the orderlies on her way to the ferry.
But you said yourself they're nutcases, Christina says. No one actually believes them. Besides, they don't know anything. Half of them think Haven is home to vampires, for God's sake. They'll get tired soon enough and find another cause. And what does that have to do with Gemma? No one could possibly know.
Someone does know, he said, cutting her off. That's the point. I'm not sending her into the middle of that mess. She can go on spring break next year.
Gemma opened her mouth and let out a long, silent scream. She imagined the sound shattering the chandelier, blowing out the windows, exploding all of her father's priceless porcelain antiques.
Fine.
Christina stood up, swaying a little on her feet. Gemma couldn't tell if it was the lingering effects of the sleeping pills, or because of the physical effort of standing up to the great Jeffrey Ives. But you have to be the one to tell her. It'll break her heart, and I won't do it.
Fine,
her father said. And then, to Gemma's horror, he flung open the door and stomped into the foyer. She turned quickly and slipped down the hall again, her heart beating out the word, unfair, unfair. In her room, she shoved Rufus aside and climbed under the covers, mounding a pillow over her head as if it could smother the sounds of what she had just heard. She waited, tight with anxiety, to hear her father's footsteps outside her door. How would she face him now? How would she face him ever again? But minutes passed, and he didn't come, and slowly the tension in her body dissipated, replaced by the heavy sensation of lying at the very bottom of a pit. She was filled with a gnawing sense of injustice, of anger, of flat-out grief. Unfair. She didn't understand half of what her parents had said. All she knew was that yet again, she was trapped. Unfair. She was like an insect in her father's hand. Maybe he got pleasure just from squeezing, from watching her squirm. She didn't think she would ever fall asleep again. But she did, eventually, hours later, when the light in her room had turned the color of dark chalk. And when she woke up, her father had been called away to Shanghai on business. And so, it was Gemma's mother who broke the news after all. Gemma, Chapter 4. She didn't go to school on Friday, claiming she was sick, and her mom didn't even bug her about what was wrong, a sure sign she knew Gemma was faking. Gemma was glad her dad was once again traveling, glad they were separated by time zones in a big ocean. She couldn't have faced him. If she had, she thought she would have spit at him, or kicked him in the shins, or finally said some of the things she'd been meaning to say for 16 years. The great Jeffrey Ives, co-founder of Fine and Ives Pharmaceuticals, master of the universe. Total fucking asshole. April called her during homeroom, a useless 15 minutes of time between second and third periods, when random juniors got shuffled together to suffer through announcements about basketball games, prom, and tolerance week. After the third time Gemma didn't pick up, April resorted to texting, flooding Gemma's phone with scowling selfies. "What the shit is going on? Are you okay?" Gemma felt a sudden surge of viciousness, a desire to cause pain, since she had been caused pain. Maybe this was how Chloe and the wolves felt. Maybe somewhere deep in their lives, someone was nipping at them, trying to make them bleed. "No," she wrote back. Then, "not going tomorrow." There was a 5-minute space between messages. Gemma wasn't sure whether April was stunned or just pretending to pay attention to her homeroom teacher. Her next message said, "This is a joke, right?" She could have written back, explaining. Better yet, she could have called. She could already imagine April shoving the phone deep into her pocket while she hurried into the nearest bathroom stall, then perching, knees to chest, on a toilet seat, and pressing the phone to her ear while Gemma sobbed. She could have explained about the broken window and her father's terrible words. "This was a message from me." It had all come true. Her crashing fears, the strange terrors that had always infected her. Her father hated her. She might someday leave, but she would never escape. Not him, not that truth, not really. But she had already cried, had woken, in fact, with her throat raw and the taste of salt on her lips, and realized she'd been crying in her sleep. And today, she felt nothing but a strange, bobbing sense of emptiness, as if she was a balloon untethered from the earth, slowly floating away into nothingness. She wondered whether her mom felt this way when she took pills. So she wrote back, "Not a joke." And, after a minute, "Sorry." Her phone stayed quiet after that. For the first 2 days of spring break, Gemma did nothing. She watched TV on her computer without knowing what she was watching. She slumped from upstairs to downstairs to microwave food her dad wouldn't have approved of her eating. The Hot Pockets and frozen mac and cheese she'd convinced Bernice, their housekeeper, to buy for her. Chinese takeout that had mysteriously materialized in the fridge. Once she took Rufus to the backyard and stood in her pajamas, blinking in the sun, while he ran circles around Danny, one of the lawn guys. She thought that was his name anyway. There had been so many, who was moving slowly on the enormous lawnmower like a ship captain through a sea of green. Her mom, who would normally have peppered Gemma with constant questions, or asked that she come have lunch at the club, or suggested they do mani-pedis, all activities that Gemma hated, largely left her alone. They were like two snowflakes, drifting through the vast white house, encased in their own arrangements of pain and misery. All, she thought, her father's fault. Her father's rules. Her father's house. Her father's walls, white and oversized, made pretty with ornate picture frames and chandeliers. So pretty they might keep a person from knowing she was trapped. Even, she realized, her father's pills. She'd never before thought about the fact that her dad's old company probably manufactured the meds her mother took, day in and day out, to help her sleep or wake or keep her from dreaming.